All right. Well, welcome to Charleston Bible Church. I see some new faces out there, at least new to me. So welcome. I am not the senior pastor. Our senior pastor's birthday is, was it yesterday? Friday. So if you haven't had a chance, go to Facebook, watch a wonderful video that the kids put together for him. That was awesome. And so he is enjoying some time alone with his wife, just taking some time off. But if you have been a part of us, you'll know that he is preaching through the book of Romans and doing a great job. And you know that a lot of attention is given to the law in the book of Romans, and specifically what the law could not do in our flesh. And so today we're going to be looking at the law from a different perspective. We're going to be looking at the law through the lens of the Sermon on the Mount. Before we do that, this is a picture taken, I think, from 2020. And the story reads, as part of a grand jury inquest, two Orange County sheriffs testified that they did not know it was against the law to falsify police reports. To virtually no one's surprise but their own, these deputies were fired and prosecuted. It was Bryce Simpson and Joseph Atkinson were caught up in a department-wide evidence scandal that was unearthed in 2019. The two were asked to account for discrepancies in their daily police reports. The report showed them submitting evidence when in reality, they had failed to do so. So you would think that policemen would be the experts in the law and that they would understand what the law is there for and understand what the law is meant to do. And yet here are these two saying, oh, we didn't know it was wrong to falsify police reports about evidence, no less. So today we're going to be talking about the Jews and particularly the Pharisees. And in the same way, you would think these Jews who knew the law better would have known how to use the law and apply the law, and yet we're going to see some abuses. So as I mentioned, we will be looking at the Sermon on the Mount. So you can turn to Matthew 5 if you'd like to go ahead and do that in your word. And you may be familiar somewhat with the Sermon on the Mount, and there's a discussion, and I would say, like many things, you see me use this motif, like there's two extremes and neither extreme would be right. So you might hear people would say that the Sermon on the Mount is for Old Testament Jews alone, and really there's nothing there for New Testament folks. And I would think that would be an extreme that is not, we can learn from the Sermon on the Mount clearly. But you also might have some folks who miss completely Jesus's trying to fix things that were wrong in the Old Testament and how he's addressing abuses by the system that was there. So either one of these extremes, oh, I don't recognize that Jesus is addressing abuses of the law, or it's only for the Old Testament would not be good. So we should read it with eyes that go, okay, Jesus is talking about how the law was abused. Here's what the law should have done. What can I learn from that? And I was figuring out what I was going to preach on when Joel was out. And yesterday morning I heard that Danny and Andy are going to partner on a study in the Sermon on the Mount. And I went to Danny and was like, is this going to collide? And we think it's fine. But yeah, if this piques your interest, you should go show up at that Bible study. All right, so you're in Matthew 5, but I'm going to quickly read Romans 8:3. It says, for what the law could not do, weak as it was through the flesh. Now, we're going to be talking a lot about the law and what it couldn't do. But who was here, ages and ages ago when Jack preached through Romans? Remember that? So there was one, I don't even see Jack here. Oh, he's went over with the kids, yeah. So there was one illustration that he gave over and over again that really stuck with me. And it was this idea of cooking a pot roast. And the question was, if you've cooked a pot roast, I'll say right, and it's just, it's just tender. You get that good cut and it's falling apart. And you try to pick that thing up with a fork, you're not going to be able to get it out because it's just going to disintegrate. We've all seen that. And so this illustration that Jack would give, like, there's nothing wrong with the fork. The fork is doing exactly what the fork was designed to do. The problem is in the flesh, in the meat of the pot roast, okay? So that's our idea here. We're not, when we're talking about abuses of the law or what the law could not do, there's nothing wrong with the law, and that's what you'll see Jesus echoing. It's because of our sinful nature that the law was unable to do what it was intended to do. So let's talk a little bit about the law. How many commandments are there in the Old Testament? 613. So some of you may have been thinking 10, and that's really a very kind of modern Christian way of thinking about it. Now we have the 10, the Decalogue that was given, not the Dodecalogue, that'd be 12, the Decalogue that was given on Mount Sinai. And so we often think of, you know, the 10 commandments, but Jews, they don't think of the commands that way. They list them all out, and in fact, we had the first one in Sunday school today, you know, to multiply and subdue the earth. And so in order to kind of get their mind wrapped around all of these laws, they combined them into what was called, became known as the Mishnah. So the Mishnah would be right here, and you can buy the Mishnah. So the Mishnah has basically all those laws collected, maybe some context for those laws. And then rabbis would talk about those laws, and they would talk about how do we keep the law? What's the best way to keep the law? And that would you'd found in the Gemara, if I'm pronouncing it right. And together, these two would form the Talmud. So if you get a complete Talmud, you would have a section on here are all those 613 laws. Here's a rabbinical commentary on how to do that. Now, coming out of, hopefully you all remember Old Testament, northern tribes were scattered, dispersed by Assyria. Two southern tribes taken into captivity, came back because of their idolatry. And Ezra, Zerubbabel, and Nehemiah, they really worked to kind of get things tightened back up. And out of that came this zeal for the law, and some of this commentary that we're even talking about came out of there. And they never wanted to experience that again, right? So if I had a place that I never wanted to get to, and I made a fence around that, and I'm like, I'm not even going to get close to breaking that law, I'm going to have a standoff, a buffer zone. So that's what happened. So these rabbis came up with what we would call fence laws that were to fence off the law so they didn't even get close to disobeying the law so they would not experience the same judgment. So here's some examples of those fence laws. Some Sabbath restrictions. The Torah commanded rest on the Sabbath, but fence laws expanded this to include prohibitions like carrying items outside your home, even indirectly. So they started getting very meticulous on this. Ritual hand washing. We see Jesus addressing this in the Gospels, talking about, you know, it's not what goes into the body that makes one unclean, but what comes out of the body. But Pharisees insisted on washing hands before meals as a ritual to avoid impurity, even though this was not directly commanded in the Torah. Tithing of spices. So you see Jesus talking about this. He's like, you tithe your mint and your dill and your cumin, but you have neglected the greater, more weighty things of the law. He's not necessarily saying don't do those things, but those things were not directly commanded in the law. Today, some of these type of fence laws survive. So any of you seen or know of an eruv? New to everyone, an eruv? So in Orthodox Judaism, certain activities restricted on the Sabbath, such as carrying items outside one's home. This restriction can make it challenging for today, you know. So what have we done? Well, Jews have put these unbroken wires or cables around large cities. So like in Manhattan, you can buy a map and you can see this section is all contained within a single eruv. And in fact, they have warning signs. You're about to go outside of the eruv here, so be careful. And these wires are there so that because they put them together, it logically puts all of that inside their home, and now they can freely move around within the city without breaking the command. So hopefully that sounds a little strange to you. Some other things present day, Shabbat elevators that will stop on every single floor because pushing a button might be considered work on the Sabbath. Can't use electricity directly on the Sabbath because a rabbi in the 1800s said, this is like fire. We can't start a fire. That's against the law, so we can't use electricity. So some synagogues are cooled by compressed air, so they'll compress air on Friday night, and they'll use that air to run their AC. Even air-compressed-powered speakers, so they would have speakers that are... I was reading an article about this last night. Pretty ingenious. I think it's the same technology as sound-powered phones, so Jay, you'll appreciate that from the Navy. But yeah, timed switches so that lights and stuff turn on so that they're not having to turn switches on. So what would we call this? Hopefully you're seeing all these rules and you're going, man, this is a little bit crazy. Legalism. So I asked ChatGPT to create a couple pictures for me on legalism. And legalism really kind of has these two sides to it. In one sense, on the left, I said, show me a picture of legalism that kind of conveys the idea of being tied down and burdened with man-made laws. And you can see that the Jewish people during Jesus' time were tied down with all of these nitpicky laws trying to keep them. But really, on the flip side, in keeping all these nitpicky laws, what they were also being done is freed from the actual law. Like, they weren't actually keeping the law as it was intended to be kept. And so this right one is supposed to show freedom from obeying God's laws. And that's what legalism does. It elevates man's rules, puts it in place of God's rules, and sometimes it can be a whole bunch of things that don't matter. But in keeping that, some people feel like they are now justified before the Lord when we know that that cannot justify them. Okay, so that is our introduction to the Sermon on the Mount. So Jesus is going to come on the scene. He's going to preach. He's going to talk the Sermon on the Mount. And hopefully you can see him addressing abuses and misuses on the law there. All right, so Matthew 5, and we're really going to read through this opening section, and I'll just provide some commentary. So Matthew 5, verse 1, says, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. He opened his mouth and began to teach them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men or people shall insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So there's a lot here. I'm sure this Bible study is going to pull those apart and really kind of pick that down and, you know, really look at the details of those. But I do want to just kind of, in summary, when you step back and you look at those often called the Beatitudes, what the proper mindset, proper emotion, proper attitude that should have been there. Poor in spirit, mournful, gentle. There's a hunger and a thirst for righteousness. When do you hunger and thirst for something? If you just had a big meal, are you hungering and thirsting? No. So it's when you've been denied those things, you hunger and thirst for them. So there should have been a hunger and thirst for righteousness, being merciful to others, pure in heart, willing to be persecuted, willing to be insulted. Does this sound like a picture of the Pharisees as presented in the New Testament? No. Does this sound like a picture of the Sadducees? No. So how could we get to an idea where we think that Jesus is addressing abuses of the law? Well, I think if we keep reading, we'll see that. But also, let's turn to a New Testament commentary on the law. Hebrews 10, 11 says, every priest stands daily ministering and offering time after time the same sacrifices which can never take away sin. Who's read the end of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy? Who would like to be in that economy where every time you sin, I'm going back to the priest, I'm saying I'm sorry, here's whether, you know, depending on the type of sin or the, what I've done, here's my offering. Every year, there's this great offering on Yom Kippur, and it never produces righteousness. That Levitical system should have shown them their sin, should have let them see, I am not what I'm supposed to be. So instead, I'm going to be poor in spirit. I'm going to be meek and lowly. I'm going to have this hunger and this thirst for this righteousness that this system ultimately cannot bring about. He'll continue. Verse 13, you are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under the foot of men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand. And it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify the Father who is in heaven. Thinking about the law, all those many different rules that were there, a lot of the ceremonial laws were meant to keep the Jewish people separate and stop them from blending in. So we think of, we probably all are breaking this law today. No clothing with mixed fibers. So unless you got 100% cotton, 100% rayon, y'all probably know the fibers better. You're breaking some of that Old Testament law because you were only supposed to have garments made of one particular fiber. No mixed seeded fields, so you couldn't sow wheat and, I don't know, corn together. You couldn't have crops that had each field had to be its own. Of course, we're familiar with all the food laws that they couldn't eat, the clean and unclean. And really, that was a system that was a part of a bigger system of being clean and unclean, and all the things that could make you clean and defiled or undefiled. And of course, you know, the first of those Ten Commandments to not be committing adultery, that would have kept. So all of these things, hopefully you can see, this would make the Jewish people peculiar in an area of people who were not acting like this, that make them different, make them set apart from those surrounding Hittites and Moabites and Ammonites. And so not only was the law to keep them separate, they were supposed to be salt. You ever had salt on a wound? Doesn't feel good, right? And it was supposed to cure and to prevent disease. But they were supposed to be light as well. They were supposed to be God's representation there to that region. And there's not a lot of missionary stuff going on in the Old Testament. Who can we think of kind of the biggest name missionary? No, in the Old Testament?
Jonah,
right. Jonah's really that one guy that's told you need to go out and spread the word because judgment is coming. There's maybe pictures of it with the Queen of Sheba coming to visit Solomon and all of Solomon, you know, kind of sharing out this is how great the Lord is. But there are hints that this is not just for the Jews. The Abrahamic covenant, and we're talking about the law, so the law is really an outworking here and now of the Abrahamic covenant for them at the time. But this is what the Lord says to Abraham. Now, the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. A blessing to whom? And I will bless those who bless you, other nations, and I will curse the one who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So from the very beginning, the you know, Abraham we count as the first Hebrew, the first Jewish person. from the very beginning, he was set apart to be a blessing to all of the earth. And that was ultimately fulfilled in Christ. He was to be a blessing. So I'm not arguing, I'm not trying to say that the Old Testament Jews had a commission like on par with our Great Commission, because we don't see that. I don't want to make more of it. But I am arguing that they had a role to be a representatives of God as a nation here on earth. And instead of fulfilling that, they became separate and haughty and proud. All right, so if you had doubts about whether Jesus was addressing the law in the Sermon on the Mount or not, hopefully his words here coming up in verse 17 will reinforce that he is addressing abuses of the law. Verse 17, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpass that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." So, what can we learn from this paragraph? The law was there to stay. It wasn't going away. Nothing, you know, until everything is fulfilled, the law is there. The law is good. Jesus says if you teach people to keep the law, that's a good thing. You're going to be rewarded. If you lead people in disobeying the law, you are going to be cursed. And the law raises a high standard for us. There's nothing wrong with the law, but weak in the flesh, that fork cannot pull the roast out. Look at this last verse. "For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpass that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, if Joel were here, what do you think he would say at the end of that? Wow. Wow. This would have been very, very jarring and shocking to a first century Jew. My righteousness surpassed that of the scribes and Pharisees, those who all day, every day, spend their lives chewing over the law, figuring out what's the biggest commandment, how does this work? And they go around with tassels, and they're fasting, and they're praying, and they're giving money. I'm supposed to be better than that to enter the kingdom? And Jesus was going to say, yeah, that's not good enough. That's actually not good enough to enter the kingdom. And so I would submit that the verses that follow detail why that's true. So he is going to now say, let me show you what I mean. Unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. And so if you look over the next few, you're going to hear Jesus, read Jesus, call out these particular references from the Old Testament. And he'll say, "You've heard, you shall not commit murder. Whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. You shall not commit adultery. Whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. You shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy." And there's references. Now, these aren't direct quotes. Some of them are summations of those. But all of these are found in the law. And Jesus is going to show them how the scribes and Pharisees of that day are abusing that. So let's take one of those and work through, because it's the same type of pattern. So let's look at murder. He says, "You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder. And whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell." So I don't know about you, but I've read this passage a lot. In fact, this is when we were younger, our youth leader had Bible memory challenges. And so it was out of the King James, which is why I've stumbled sometimes. I've slipped back into the King James as I've read this. But so this was a passage that I had memorized. So I had thought quite a bit about this. But if you look at the commands, at the infractions and the punishments, maybe you can see a pattern. If you're guilty of murder, and it's the same Greek word. I'm not sure. I tried to do some research of why it gets translated differently. But the same Greek word underneath this liable or guilty to the core or in danger of, it's the same Greek word behind all of those. So I just translated the same in my comparison. But if you have committed murder, then you're liable to the court, which could have been a local convening of the elders. If you're angry, same result. You're liable or guilty to the court. But if you said to someone, you know what, you are good for nothing, well, now you're liable or guilty to the Supreme Court. And if you just say to someone, man, you are stupid, you're in danger of fiery hell. So what do we, hopefully you can see, like, the offenses seem to be going down, but the punishments are ramping up. We see that. And I think Jesus is trying to, you know, just turn the screws on these guys to help them see that this commandment to not murder, don't do that action, but that sin starts way earlier. There is a corrective that he gives. Therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and present your offering. If you got some amnesty between you and the brother, that needs to get fixed. It's almost like he's saying that offering that you're giving is kind of worthless right now while you have this going on. And then don't be angry. That's why I take 25 to basically be, don't be an angry person. Don't be a hard to get along person. Make friends quickly with your opponent at the law while you're with him on the way, so that your opponent may not hand you over to the judge and the judge the officer, and you may be thrown in the prison. Truly I say to you, you will not come out until you have paid up the last cent. So he kind of gives a corrective to this. And hopefully you can see that instead of fencing off physical things in their law, maybe they should have been fencing off their heart, right? Right? So, hey, if I don't want to murder, I better not get angry. And if I don't want to get angry, probably I shouldn't think thoughts like, you're good for nothing. And if I don't want to think thoughts like you're good for nothing, then maybe I shouldn't think, oh man, he's stupid, right? He's really getting to literally the heart of the matter. And he's going to repeat this pattern. So if you were to read through the next ones, we would go back through that list. He's going to talk about the abuses of adultery and marriage, the abuses of giving a certificate of divorce, and he's going to have this pattern. Here's what you've heard, and this is how you're acting, and you've missed it. Let me give you the corrective to this so that you're actually fencing off your heart. Now, at the end, he's going to give this conclusion at the end of chapter 5. He's going to say, therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. So hopefully you can see this as a big section that gets kicked off with, for I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Let me show you how they're missing it. Let me show you how you're missing it, verses 21 through 47, where he's going through all those. You've heard, you've heard, you've heard. And then his conclusion is, therefore you are to be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Easy to do, right? Easy peasy. We got that all day. Being perfect as your Father is in heaven, right? No, that's not good news. That's not good news at all. If you were to flip over, the Sermon on the Mount doesn't stop in chapter 5. He's going to address abuses of good works, doing them before men. abuses of prayer, abuses in fasting, over-concern for earthly goods, hypocritical judging starts off chapter 7, how to properly love others, and then he's going to give warnings about what it means to follow the law. So hopefully, especially if you know, take some time, dig into the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 6, 7, 5, 6, 7, and 8, in 5, 6, 7, sorry, in Matthew, and you'll see, oh, maybe there's a different way of understanding what Jesus is doing. He is addressing abuses of the law. All right, so back to our Romans passage. For what the law could not do, weak as it was through the flesh, and it doesn't end there, thankfully. Right? It doesn't stop there. Because what the law could not do, what the Jews couldn't do 300, 400, 500 years where they tried to figure out how to keep the law the best, God did. God did for us what the law could not do in us by sending his own son in the likeness of sinful flesh. As an offering for sin, he condemned sin in the flesh so that the requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. What the law could not do, God did by sending his son. And, you know, I think, you know, there's another time where Jesus is really addressing the law and the burden that the Pharisees were putting on the people. And this is what he said in Matthew 11, come to me. If you're trying to keep the law better than the scribes and Pharisees, and hopefully in doing that, you should be hungry and thirsty for righteousness. You should be mourning. You should be poor in spirit because you're not going to do it. If you are burdened by the demands of the law and you can't do it, come to me. Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. What we could not do, Jesus did for us. God did for us by sending his son. All right, something a little less serious than this. Jackie got a couple shout-outs today. So the one, you know, the fork and the roast, you remember that? Yeah. So about the same time, Jack was teaching a Sunday school over in that building. We had the round tables out. I remember it well. And I don't remember what the Sunday school was on, but I remember you mentioning this book, The Tyranny of the Urgent. And it was about, you know, discipline. I think you were talking about disciplines and how we live our, you know, discipline our lives. And you had said something like, have you read Tyranny of the Urgent? And I'm sitting there right next to Jill, and she said, we don't have time. But no one heard it but me. So if Jill were telling this joke, she would say, then I went, we would have read it, Jack, but we don't have time. And then everyone laughed. And so she felt like she got cheated from her original joke. So what's the point? So the point is, Jill did all the work of coming up with this joke, and I benefited from it, right? I got the delivery and the laughs. And in the same way, much lesser to the much greater, Jesus has done the work for us. He has lived a life of righteousness, fulfilling the law that we could never do. He took a death payment penalty on the cross for us to make up for our bad deeds. What the law could not do, weak as it was to flesh, God did, sending his own son. So application, are you guarding, are you fencing off your heart? I think each of us, if your life is similar to mine, there's certain areas of sin that you struggle with, and there's certain steps, paths that lead on their triggers. You probably deal with this in counseling, Tim. And what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to cut off those triggers. We're supposed to fence those off from our life so that we don't take those first steps, just like in murder. I don't think that guy's stupid, therefore I don't call him names, therefore I don't get angry at him, therefore I don't murder him, right? We cut that sin off at the start. Are you fencing off your heart? Do you tend to be rules-based, kind of on the legalistic side? I think we probably all tend, or grace-based on the license side. And really, there's got to be a balance here. It's both a relationship with Christ where we have grace, but at the same time, we are walking in the Spirit and we're walking in a way. And I would suggest these foundational blocks. I know we say them all the time. You hear Joel say them all the time, Acts 2:42. At one point in time, it occurred to me that if the church is going to be an Acts 2:42 church, then families that tend that church, those need to be Acts 2:42 families. And if a family's going to be an Acts 2:42 family, then the individuals in that family have to be Acts 2:42 people. And so you need to be about the word, about prayer, about fellowship, about worship and praising God. And if you're here and you have not found rest in Jesus, if you're trying to be good enough to earn salvation, it's never going to work. Hopefully you see that. And if you haven't put your trust in Jesus, if you haven't found rest in him, I would invite you to do that today. All right, and with that, we're going to turn to the communion. So I will pray, and I'll ask the men who are helping with